Which brings me to green cities, which also arise as ambitions in the USA, but with a mixed record. This is what Peter Bernhardt in St. Louis, Missouri, has been thinking about with us versus them.
Sometimes art imitates life. Sometimes life imitates art. And sometimes applied science in America tries to imitate applied science in Australia. How is that again? On Friday, the 13th of September, I attended a day-long symposium at the Missouri Botanical Garden entitled Making St. Louis the Nature City of the 21st Century. It was organized by the Living Earth Collaborative, and this consortium of local scientific institutions includes our botanical garden, the zoo, and Washington University. They are committed to sharing research projects devoted to biodiversity and conservation science. Based on what I learned that day, America remains behind many Eurasian and Australian cities in urban biology. St. Louis, in particular, has a long way to go. We have never published a book about the inner city's flora, unlike Dublin, Ireland, or even a booklet identifying our city's spiders, unlike Toronto, Canada. We were shown glorious photos of Singapore with its vertical gardens, terraced trees, and re-engineered Kallang River, absorbing the city's floodwaters while supporting families of dozens of otters. To add insult to injury, St. Louis began as a trading post on the Mississippi River, but we still don't have an artificial wetland that Perth developed back in 2010. Ironically, this is the same urban wetland that Perth Council plans to demolish in favor of a cultural center. How can St. Louis residents emulate foreign advances? The first speakers included public servants, engineers, and professors who quickly introduced us to such phrases as nature-based solutions, ecosystem services, and biophilic elements. We were reminded that St. Louis already has more than 100 parks, and that sounds promising when you consider we are a mid-sized American city with only 280,000 residents, but 80% of the land is privately owned. These people spoke about applications in the face of climate change. They appeared convinced that more canopy trees and restoration of tall grass prairies will mean redirecting and absorbing more stormwater, lower the temperatures produced by the urban heat island effect, and reduce levels of ozone and air pollution. It was interesting to note that most of them equated a greener city with improving the physical and mental health of its citizens. I'm a little skeptical. Yes, growing more native C3 grasses and long-lived trees will remove urban carbon, and that may protect children with asthma and may even make it easier for people with symptoms of Parkinson's disease. However, as a botanist, I know that most of America's canopy trees and all of our native grasses are wind-pollinated, and that's a problem for those of us with pollen-based allergies. Would a St. Louis homeowner be happy to plant another mighty oak after the last one crashed through her roof following our annual tornado and hurricane cycles? I agree that nature is resilient and can make us more resilient. Sometimes. But I wondered if some participants were citing some rather dubious reports because they justified their professions and salaries. In particular, how would the real residents of my city's slums have reacted to our plenary speaker when he announced that planting trees on abandoned lots reduced drug sales and gun violence. As a resident of American cities for 60 of my 72 years, I find it hard to believe that urban gangs commit fewer crimes when the corner grove of redbud trees comes into bloom. Four urban scientists spoke next, and it was refreshing. All admitted they were involved in ongoing studies, and they were sharing data that might have practical applications someday. The Emir honeysuckle, an aggressive invasive shrub, has a competitive advantage over native plants because it drops its leaves so late in autumn. Cyclical burns control it while encouraging prairie grasses. A second researcher has begun sampling soils in some of the oldest neighborhoods. A full survey will take years as the practice of building new foundations on demolished properties seals the original soil layers. We were all surprised to learn, though, that segments of the city retain buried portions of the original rich black prairie soil deposited by the advancing glaciers and exposed by their retreat within the last 12 to 18,000 years. My own favorite was Mike Dawson of the Spring Peeper program of Frog Watch, St. Louis. With the help of citizen scientists, he locates surviving populations of three species of tree frogs in the St. Louis area that become sexually active as ice melts in wintry February. He locates and records three species by their calls. Spring peepers peep. But the boreal chorus frog sounds like a fingernail raked over a comb. And Blanchard's cricket frog sounds like someone clicking two marbles together. When his recorded calls prove too low for the audience to hear, Dr. Dawson gleefully imitated them for us. The various talks gave way to a lavish buffet lunch, discussion groups, poster sessions, and videos. I think we all picked up sound information, but it left me wondering, how far behind are we in St. Louis compared to Australia? Americans are just beginning to unite academic and citizen scientists into long-term and meaningful programs. We don't have the equivalent of Kit Prendergast's Bees in the Burbs, or the people studying the learning behaviors of Sydney's cockatoos, or locating the platypuses still living in Hobart's creeks. Consider yourself fortunate.
We do, Peter, we do. Peter Bernhardt in St. Louis with strong associations to the Botanic Gardens there. So, how do we compare? Who better to ask than Professor Peter Newman over at Curtin University with his long efforts to help make us city dwellers more biophilic. And so, here he is online.
Well, this is all about Peter Bernhardt's assessment of green cities in the future, and he's been very complimentary about Western Australia, and I know that in reply you did note the fact that he was less complimentary about most American cities, but you found that there were quite a few that were doing well.
Yes, I'm part of the Biophilic Cities Network, which Tim Beatley established at the University of Virginia, and it brings in local governments from all across the country. So Perth and Wellington and other places are involved, and it is a great network of people who give every week what they're doing, and some of the highlights are real highlights. I just absolutely love to hear about what is going on and how they're finding how to put big trees into the centre of cities and how they can make sure they survive. And all of that technological prowess that America has, they are putting into nature-based systems in their cities. And they're very inspiring. So I can see it happening at a very grassroots level. If you go to these cities, it'd probably be even better.
I see. Give me one more example of the sort of thing you like apart from trees in cities. What else are they doing? Just one example.
Well, I think the restoration of the rivers. San Antonio started that with their river going through the middle of it, and they restored that river as part of a tourist approach, and it was very popular. So now the Los Angeles River, Colorado River, these projects are very big rivers that have been essentially turned into drains and sewers and all kinds of terrible things, and they build around them. They tried to make them very modernist style ways of pushing water down a chute. And rivers, of course, are fabulous ecosystems and they keep coming back, but they need help. And so the restoration of the soft foreshores, the way in which the water can spread out when it's heavily flowing and then come back in when it's not, all of that is now being restored in many of their rivers, and I think it's very inspirational. Some of the work, mostly in the West, is very inspirational. You can go on the web and see some of these things. They're extraordinary.
Very encouraging. Now, there was one criticism that he made about the intention, perhaps, in Perth to do away with one of the most famous wetlands. I think it's the Josh Byrne wetland, it's called, that there's rebuilding going on. How's that going at the moment? Is that really a problem?
Yeah, well, Josh Byrne AM, just received, has done a fabulous job with that and a number of other wetland projects. That one became very popular because it's right in the centre of Perth, built on top of a concrete car park, but it is symbolic because it is a wetland where the original wetlands were in Perth that were the reason for Indigenous people locating there and finding it as a major food source, a major place of gathering. And it was one of the reasons it was then taken over by Captain Stirling and turned into a CBD. So it was very symbolic to restore that and make it a very popular place. The whole area is doing much better than it was before, but the state government are now redeveloping the whole area to make it even more people-friendly, as they want, and they hopefully will recreate the wetland now as part of that, because if they don't, they'll get a very big reaction to it. You can recreate it, but it is a pity if we lose that very natural-looking place that's got its own structural changes that you can have seen over the years as the different ecologies have grown in it, and it's very, very popular because of that. But I think it would be a great pity if we lose that. And I think the awareness of that is very big now in Perth.
And, of course, Josh Byrne, very well known. Of course, you've seen him many, many times on the gardening programme on the ABC, often playing with compost. And he has your professorship, the one that you vacated, I think, at the Curtin University.
No, he didn't take over from me. I'm still there.
Oh, you're still there, right?
I have gone to a three-day-a-week research contract, but Josh, he is the Professor of Sustainable Futures at Curtin, and he's been doing some amazing things in that role. So Professor Byrne is doing well at bringing nature back into cities in a very clear and obvious way to improve our cities, and that's a major issue for him.
Another famous name from Western Australia, of course, Tim Winton, and I think you've written that some of the things in his latest book, Juice, where he looks to the future and the ways in which the opposite of green cities happen, he gives loads of examples of the ways in which cities can be ruined, in fact. Is that right?
Yes, it's a scary book to read, and to the extent that they're not even sure they want to release it in America at this time... I think it's understandable too, with the crazy things that are happening there that they seem to see as being real. But this book is a very important one in terms of climate change, because it's looking into the future, perhaps 100 years or so, when so much has not happened in terms of getting rid of fossil fuels and those companies have come back to maintain their profits at all costs, and the all costs is that most cities in the world are collapsing because of the heat and people are needing to live underground or in special canyons, and all the wealthy are finding how to do that, but the poor, of course, are just disappearing or becoming slaves. And this kind of future is potentially one that you have to take seriously, because civilizations do come and go, and we could collapse this one if we don't solve this problem of net zero, particularly in our cities. I'll just get a plug in for me. I'm putting in a new book today. It's called Net Zero Cities with Sustainability, a Practitioner's Approach. And this is telling us how to do it, how to get on with it quick, because we really need it. But it also has a lot of very positive data on how quickly the market is picking it up, and that it is likely to mean that withdrawal from Paris by the Americans is not going to mean much, because the market is so strong now. And I think it's a very positive direction, but we can't just wait for the market. We have to assist it, because otherwise the politics will take over, and all of those fossil fuel companies will just keep preventing it from happening. And that's Tim Winton's scenario that he's presented in Juice.
One final question, and this is one of the examples which I think you may have hinted at in your new book when it comes out. There's lots of suggestion that there are ways of replacing concrete, the old-fashioned concrete, which is producing so much in the way of emissions. And indeed, I did an interview with somebody actually from East London University. She's from Africa, and it's quite interesting how they have a proposition there, an experiment which seems to be producing results, and indeed has an example of the way in which sugarcrete, in other words, you take the various wastes from various crops, such as sugar, and you use that fibre to make bricks instead of using the old-fashioned sort of concrete, which is producing CO2. Are there examples like that that could take off?
Yeah, look, I think this is a very important area of research, and the science of it is critical to understanding this. In my book, we talk about solar, wind, batteries, electric vehicles as being not needing the R&D now. They're commercial, they can be bought, they're cheaper than the alternatives. But concrete, the processing of minerals, and aviation and shipping are the big issues that still need a lot of research. They need breakthroughs. And there are a lot coming out, and every day I seem to get new papers that are showing options like this one. That seems to me like a very important one for the global south, to be able to use biomass more in making bricks. In Perth, we've got a product called Collycrete, which is now able to commercially compete with concrete, and it doesn't involve that Portland cement approach, which takes so much energy, and it doesn't need fossil fuels. That's been developed at Murdoch University, and Martin Ander there has come up with a formula that uses local materials that can be put into a concrete. So I think if we keep going with these approaches, we will have 100% commercial opportunities in the next 10, 15 years that will enable us to get to net zero. It's a question of us really putting that into our cities, making every new project a net zero project and getting on with it, because they work, people love it, they are very much better in our cities. We can do this. The juice option is not something we can even consider any further. But thank you, Tim, for writing about it and scaring us like mad.
Peter Newman at Curtin University in Perth with Tim Winton's new novel, Juice, on his desk. Thanks, Peter. And look out for Josh Byrne on Gardening Australia, ABC Television.